fact us. If he tells you the hiding place, you have no reason to give us the map." Mr. D looked at the captain, a hint of scorn in the curve of his mouth.
"I didn't know you let your daughter make your deals."
Slate's face was stony.
"I've told you before, she's more of an expert than me."
Mr. D wet his lips.
"I don't suppose you'd accept my word of honor?"
"Fine," he said when I laughed.
"Hart will hand the map over after the gold is hidden."
"After it's stolen," I countered, "or we'll leave it on the palace steps." Behind his beard, Mr. D clenched his teeth.
"It doesn't matter to me," he said,
all appearances to the contrary.
"After it's stolen, then, how long will it take for you to make your preparations?"
Kashmir and Slate both looked to me for the answer, and despite the circumstances, I felt the glow of pride. "It won't seem long to you," I said. "All we need to get started is a map. One of here and now, so we can return after we fetch what we need. I trust you can commission another from Mr. Sutphen." Slate glanced at me, and then at Mr. D. I hadn't had the chance to tell him about the map, but Mr. D didn't even bat an eye.
"Why not use the one you have?"
I shook my head. "It has to be inked now, after we've made all our arrangements."
"But it takes the man half a year at least," Millie said.
I shrugged. "I've heard patience is a virtue." Mr. D's veneer of civility was thinning quickly.
"The longer we wait for the theft," he growled, "the longer you wait for the map."
The captain glared at him.
"If you think 6 months is a long time, try waiting 16 years.
Mr. Hart sat forward, catching Mr. D's eye.
"I know someone who can draw,"
he said hurriedly, perhaps trying to diffuse the tension.
"He made the copy you showed the captain. He's not busy."
Mr. D nodded, in my chest a sinking feeling.
"Good," Slate said. "Send him to the ship tomorrow. We'll all cross our fingers he can work fast. I won't be sorry to weigh anchor on this port."
And finally, Slate gave in, and reached out for a cup of tea, not his, which was empty, but mine. He downed the lot in one gulp. Chapter 26. The next dawn, when the Caladrius alighted on the rail, I was ready with a biscuit in a box. The bird considered my proposal long and hard before deciding that hopping into the crate, which I'd found in the hold and emptied of penicillin, was an acceptable trade for a bit of bread. But when she did, I closed the box gently and set out for Chinatown. I had to wait for Joss to open the shop, but she didn't seem surprised to find me on her doorstep.
"You have money?"
"Better," she laughed.
"What is better than money?"
"A cure." I opened the box, and the Caladrius tilted her head up toward her face and stared for several heartbeats. I watched the film spread like a caul over the pebble-black eyes. The bird ruffled her feathers, then shot straight up out of the box and toward the sun to burn away the blindness. I regarded Joss. Her eyes were as wide and clear as a cloudless night sky.
"Ah,"
she said, after a very long moment, still staring at the empty box. She blinked twice, and on her wrinkled lips, the hint of a genuine smile. Her eyes roved over my face.
"You do look like her. Your cheeks, your chin."
But the smile faded.
"You do not have her confidence. You are adrift like your father. You are his daughter more than hers."
She turned away.
"Come inside," she said,
leading me into the shop. I set down the empty crate inside the door. I didn't mince words. "You know how to navigate."
"I traveled in my youth, yes," she said.
Her voice was soft, distracted, as she peered around the shop she must not have seen clearly for years.
"Your father is special, but he is not unique."
"How many others are there?"
"I have only ever met two I recognized as such, other than myself."
She walked down the length of the store, drawing me behind her like a ship after a tug.
"Who?" "You know them well."
She ran her hand over the top of a glass jar and grimaced at the dust on her fingertips. I narrowed my eyes. "Then my father is one. But who is the other?" She gave me a disappointed look, but I had already come to the answer.
"Me?
But that's... how can you know for sure?"
"I told you, I have seen your future."
I gnawed my thumbnail, unsure whether or not I believed her.
"What did you see, exactly?" "You told me you didn't want to know."
I made a face. I should have known better than to pay in advance. I reached into my pocket and fished for coins.
"If you want your half dollar..." "That's no longer the price."
"Well, that's all I'm willing to pay." We stared each other down, and to my surprise, she broke first, her eyes sparkling as she laughed. It made her look very young.
"I was wrong. You are like her."
She reached out and touched my cheek. Her hand was soft and cool. Then she drew back and tottered to her spot behind the counter.
"I saw you at the helm of the black ship. You took hope to a barren shore and gave a woman a new life."
"That's sufficiently vague."
"It will come to pass by the time the week is out. Afterward, you may regret not asking further into the future."
"I don't care who I'll marry, and I don't want to know how I die."
"I don't see why not. I myself will never marry, and I will die in the Great Fire in 1886.
Suddenly the room seemed narrow, and my heart squeezed in my chest.
How did she know?
The Chinatown fire?
Where else would I be?
You can really see the future.
Can't we all? I just have clearer eyes than most, especially now.
A favor to ask, she said then. For a price? I countered. Joss laughed again.
Certainly. In exchange, I will give you hope.
She slid a cylindrical leather case out from under the counter and put it in my hands, moving confidently now.
I will keep this box, she said,
picking up the crate I'd brought the Galadrius in, as part of your payment to me. I opened the case and slid out the map. Chinatown in 1886, in the aftermath of the fire. Ah. A thick black line demarcated the outline of the destruction of the blaze, and near the center someone had inked an X in red.
Where did you get this? From your father, 15 years ago. He asked me to tell his fortune. This map was his payment.
What does the X mark?
X marks buried treasure.
She went back to the counter, dragging the box behind her.
A note. An elixir for my condition. Money. A map of 1841. Everything I'll need for a new life.
Hope, she'd said, and a barren shore.
You'll come here in 1886, after the fire you died in? I came here in 1886, which was after the fire I will die in. I was a young woman at the time I arrived, and poisoned besides, but with the payment from Mr. D, I was able to make my way.
Poisoned? I put my hand to my temple, trying to piece it all together. You came here in 1886, dug up this box, and went back to 1841. I give you a new life? She only smiled, but but the importance of that had come to me. And you introduced my parents. No answer. She took out a sheet of rice paper and a brush, drawing choppy characters in short, quick strokes. If you know you'll die in the fire, why stay here now? If you know your fate, why wait for it? She paused then, her expression almost puzzled.
Because it is mine, she said, as though it was obvious. Everything must come to an end, Nix. Your father would be happier if he could accept that.
She glanced over the letter she was writing, finding her place.
Besides, she murmured, there is always a sacrifice. If I was already there, I never could have come.
You can't come to a map where you already exist? She didn't answer my question. Rather, she already had. My hand crept up to my necklace. New York, 1981. That's why it didn't work.
Didn't you ever wonder why all the maps he's collected failed?
Of course I did, but he wasn't here in 1868.
No, she said. You were.
I put my palms down on the counter to steady myself. So this whole plan is pointless? The map Mr. D is selling is a dead-ender?
As long as he tries to take you with him.
She paused in her brush strokes.
Of course, as long as you stay with him, you know you are safe, she said.
So it's possible? He could erase my past?
That I cannot say,
she said, and her regret nearly seemed real. Because you don't know? Or because there's nothing else you want in exchange for the information?
Because it would only be what I believe, and that is not what matters when you are traveling through the fog. But I do believe that some things are meant to be.
She blotted the letter, then rolled it, and tucked it into the leather case. Then she sighed.
Leave it on the shore. Don't forget. I was close to him, you see, because I was his favorite.
Whose favorite?
Do you still have the numbers I gave you? Remember them well, she said, ushering me out the door. Goodbye, Nix. I don't think I will see you again in the time I have left. Although you may see me.
I returned to the ship, walking slowly. She had known what I was planning. Of course she did. She'd seen it years ago. She'd even sold me the map. But she'd given me this one. The map she needed to escape, and a note to tell herself how. The leather case was heavy across my back. What would happen if I threw it overboard and let it sink to the bottom of the bay? I took the case in my hands as I reached the dock, the hungry sea rolling at my feet. Something wild inside dared me. I might discover, in an instant, for a moment, what was truly possible. But I couldn't do it. Chapter 27. I was still standing on the dock when the mapmaker arrived.
Miss Song?
I gripped the leather case in my hands like a talisman. Blake was carrying a black portfolio under his arm and a box of pens.
If I am to draw you a map, he said, you must first promise me that you'll not become sentimental over it.
A smile began to creep unbidden across my lips. I bit them hard to chase it away. I suppose you'd best come up. Hearing our voices, Kashmir looked over the rail and laughed.
Ah, Mr. Hart, if I'd known to expect you, I'd have gotten a lay, though I suppose I could still dredge up a handful of seaweed.
I'm sorry we got off on the wrong foot, Mr. Ferris, Blake said blandly. I can see now that your propriety is matched only by your good manners.
Kashmir grinned as he sauntered off to knock on the captain's door. Slate met us on the deck, his eyes bleary and flat.
You.
Blake didn't flinch under his unrelenting stare, but the captain was studying him as though he was a new species.
"What are you, an amateur cartographer?" Slate said finally. "Even worse, sir, an amateur artist."
Slate scoffed, waving a vague hand in my face.
"You're taking care of this?"
"Aye, Captain."
"Good," he said, peering at Blake again. "There's a drafting table in my cabin, but don't lay a finger on anything else." "I assure you, Captain," Blake said, "my intentions are honorable."
Slate cocked his head. Understanding dawned on his face.
"I meant, don't touch my stuff." He rolled his eyes. "I need some coffee."
Then he strode off toward the hatch without a backward glance. But Kashmir was watching, his arms folded, standing against the door to the captain's cabin. As we approached, he smiled thinly.
"Don't they say the road to hell is paved with honorable intentions?"
"That's good intentions," I said, making a face.
"Ah, yes, of course."
He turned the knob and opened the door with a flourish.
"But perhaps Mr. Hart can go to hell anyway."
I stepped inside easily, but Kashmir forced Blake to squeeze past him. I put my hand on the door, but he lingered in the doorway. "Thank you, Kashmir," I said.
"I can come in to protect you from his intentions, if you like."
"I can handle it." I shut the door firmly, with him on the other side of it. The air in the cabin was cool, and Blake's expression was chillier still.
"I think your father does you a disservice letting him near you."
I folded my arms. "He's my best friend."
"You don't exactly seem spoiled for choice."
But he held up his hand.
"I apologize, Miss Song. I will not further impugn your crewmate."
His eyes moved past mine to the shelves lining the walls.
"You have so many maps," he said then, moving around the room.
He inhabited the space differently than I did. He was tentative, considerate, as though everything was delicate and of great value. He laid his pens and his hat on the drafting table and reached toward the shelves. I took a breath, but his fingertips stopped inches away from a touch.
"Where are you going for the money?"
"What?"
"My father said you need a map so you may return, and it would seem you haven't yet purchased his map, since he is still in debt. You must be sailing to retrieve the payment. Where are you going?"
"New York," I said. It was the first thing that came to mind. "My father has his accounts there."
"Such a long journey. Couldn't he have the funds wired to California?"
I wasn't about to get mired in more lies. Instead, I went on the offensive. "Do you want to tell my father how to manage his finances?"
It worked. "Forgive me," he said. "It's just that part of me hadn't been expecting something so prosaic. I was imagining treasure maps and gold doubloons," he said, gesturing at the cupboards. Then he sighed. "And when do you sail?"
"As soon as you're done with the map."
"Is that so? No wonder my father was so eager. It might be satisfying to delay," he said, raising one eyebrow. "And not only to spite the league."
I tried to look stern.
"Mr. Hart, I'm eager to spite your tutor."
I did laugh then, and his smile bloomed. Then he opened the portfolio and removed a wide sheet of vellum. It floated like a petal in his hands. He smoothed it onto the table, his inky fingers in sharp contrast to the pure cream of the page.
"Instruct me, Miss Song. What am I to draw for you?"
"Here," I said, opening one of the cupboards and selecting a map. "Let me show you what we need." I unrolled the paper. "Here's the map we used to get here."
"Ah."
His eyes roamed over the page, and after a moment he raised his eyes to mine.
"Sutphen, 1868? But he's only been in business since 1877. It's painted right there on his window."
He misstated the map, I said.
What an odd thing to do.
Indeed. I sensed his questions coming, like a swelling wave, but there was nothing for it. Now, we'll need a current map of Oahu to return.
But,
Blake scanned the page,
this seems, but for the date.
Yes, it's a very good map, I said, but we still need a new one. You may use the Sutphin as a template, I continued hurriedly, but don't copy it exactly. Anything you know has changed recently on the island. You should make the change on the page. His brow furrowed.
Changes in the harbor, or on the island itself?
Either. He laughed.
You can't be worried about running aground on Princess Pauahi's mausoleum.
If it has changed since Sutphin did his map, please just draw it.
What happens if I don't?
If you don't, I hesitated, but in this case, perhaps the truth could indeed set me free. If you don't, we will not be coming back once we go. The map must be accurate, or we cannot return. He looked at me sideways, and, perhaps seeing my expression, for once he did not ask why. Instead, he gave me that half-smile.
The mystery deepens, Miss Song.
His eyes were so inviting that, for a moment, everything in me wanted to reveal this part of myself, as though the truth was a butterfly, wings fluttering, green and gold and quivering to be free. I was a closed book, a rolled map, a dark territory, uncharted. I was surprised by my urgency, but after all, to be known was to exist. A knock at the door interrupted my thoughts. Kashmir didn't wait for an answer. He breezed into the room, juggling a lantern, a pair of buckets, and a piece of flat glass.
I thought you could use this.
He upended the buckets on the floor, put the lantern between them, and balanced the glass over the whole assembly.
You can backlight the original and mark off the measurements, he said. Should make it all go faster, and the faster, the better.
Thank you, Blake said. Did your people invent this too?
Get to work, Mr. Hart.
Then he propped the door open and went back outside, leaving a long silence in his wake. I sighed. Do you have any more questions about the map? Blake didn't answer immediately. He was tapping one finger absently on the table, and his eyes were far away.
I believe you've implied, he said slowly, that your payment to the Hawaiian League depends on the accuracy of my work.
Have I? My eyes went to the open door, but he had kept his voice low. You should strive for integrity, I said. But if the map is inaccurate, the captain won't know until it's too late. Blake worked for days. He spent half his time practicing in his sketchbook, sitting on the floor, his back against the wall, his knees bent like an easel, with a book propped upon them. Once his techniques were perfected, he'd turn to the map, hunching over the drafting table with intense focus. He took pains with the path of each meandering stream, careful with the curves of the scalloped shorelines, and traced the lacy edges of bays and inlets with a slow, steady hand. He wrote the names of each region and city with even block letters. He smudged ink into the valleys and shaded the elevation of the mountains, using a technique I would have called pointillism, if I could have remembered whether the term was in wide use yet. Instead, I settled on admiring the details in the work.
Sutphin should have done better. See here.
He swept his pens and inks to one side of the table and unrolled the old map side by side with his version.
On his, you see the structure marked Old Ruin? It's the foundation of Kamehameha III's summer home, Kaneaka Pupu,
he pointed.
I've put that in.
And here, where his map shows nothing, there's actually another ruin of a heiau. And, of course, the waterfall I showed you.
And lots of villages Sutphin missed. I hope it's not too much.
You are an expert. You did all this from memory?
Ah, well, he grinned at me. When you like something well enough, certain details become unforgettable.
I couldn't help it. I laughed, delighted.
I can start over if you'd like.
Try again?
With the map, I mean.
The map, of course. No, I said. I love seeing the islands through your eyes. My gaze fell on his sketchbook on the corner of the table, and I reached for it. In fact, the maps you... His hand darted out under mine to cover the book. I froze. His face had gone serious. No, trepidatious. But after a long moment, he removed his hand and turned back to the map.
Go ahead,
he said, almost brusquely, picking up one of his pens to refill the ink in the reservoir. I took the sketchbook. Suddenly, I was nervous, too. But my curiosity overcame my hesitation. I opened the book and found what I'd hoped, what I'd feared. I thought you'd been practicing drawing the map, I said softly as I flipped through the pages.
I never thought I'd find a more compelling subject than the islands,
he said, still pretending to focus on the pen. Then he looked up through his lashes.
I wanted to capture you before you were gone.
My lips parted, but not to speak. Warmth crept into my stomach like sunlight through deep water. But I turned my head, confused, and immediately regretted it. It took another half day to place the last flourishes. He added a tiny square to represent Princess Pauahi's new tomb at Mona Ala, as well as a detailed decorative compass rose. He did seem to be dawdling as he worked, taking his time at meals and breaks for fresh air, though he no longer spent time sketching. Eventually, though, despite the distractions and delays, there was nothing left to add but his name, and the map was complete. It was a work of art, rich in details only he knew. Had he drawn accurately, or had he added something in, something imperceptible to me, to keep us from returning and prevent the Hawaiian League from collecting its payment? I couldn't tell, and I wouldn't ask. Blake chewed his lip as Slate studied the paper, spread across the drafting table. The captain gave it his highest praise, considering he was in one of his darker moods, a nod and a hint of a grim smile. He showed Blake and me to the door.
Make ready,
he called to the crew. Then he shut the door hard behind us. Blake raised his eyebrow.
You're leaving so soon?
Before the day ends. I led him off the ship, dodging around the sudden flurry of activity, and we both stood on the dock, at the base of the gangplank, reluctant to say goodbye.
I should have worked more slowly.
I thought of Joss then, gazing clear-eyed at her future. Why hold off the inevitable?
Why, for the sake of the ephemeral, Miss Song, he said, and in the hope of making it last.
My paths diverged, and for a moment I imagined I, too, could see the future. But two versions, the ship and the shore. I stood frozen for what seemed like an hour, an eternity. Was I more like my father than I thought? No. The beauty of the ephemeral was in its impermanence. I couldn't have let myself feel for Blake had I not known there would be an end, and I could admit it now. I did feel for him. There was safety here, at the end of our short story, and it made me bold. Though my heart shook like a luffing sail, I would not leave the moment with only my regrets. So I rose up on my tiptoes and kissed him before I could think twice. It was strange and stomach-churning and over too soon. Still, his pale cheeks went even paler, and then the bright pink spots reappeared, deep as the blush on a ripe apricot.
You've changed me,
he breathed.
I never thought I would look longingly out to sea.
I gathered my own longings in my fists, clenched by my sides. Goodbye, Blake. The seconds stretched, but then he tipped his hat.
Nix.
When he rode away, he did not look back. I knew, because I watched until he was out of sight. Chapter 28. We clipped along under our unfurled sails, their bellies full with the breeze, and soon the city of Honolulu was just a dark smudge on the thin gold band of the shoreline. Then I realized Slate and I were both watching the shore as it receded. So I turned to face the sea, and the sight of the open horizon was as heady as the salt wind. After Blake had gone, I had placed the map we'd be using, the map Joss had sold me, the ancient, crumbling piece of paper, probably among the very first pieces of paper ever made, on the wide drafting table. I'd unfolded it carefully, teasing it apart. It was stamped in faded red at the bottom, and brushed with quick, bold strokes of ink and choppy handwriting. As Joss had promised, the map did indeed depict the tomb of Emperor Qin, who had died in the 2nd century B.C. The Chinese historian Sima Qian had described it in his historical opus, the Shiji. After his death, and just before all he built had crumbled, Emperor Qin had been buried in a massive underground complex underneath Mount Li in Shaiyung. He rested in a representation of his palace placed in the center of a scale model of China itself, with rolling hills cast of bronze, mountains assembled out of fine-cut stone, and rivers and seas of mercury. Along with the rich clothes, fine jewels, and masterly weapons with which most prestigious persons were buried during that era, Emperor Qin was guarded in death by some 8,000 terracotta warriors. They were what had caught my interest. As Joss had mentioned, the legend said that in the lofty vault of the tomb, these warriors had sprung to attention to serve the emperor in his afterlife, along with the various terracotta acrobats, jugglers, musicians, and concubines. This clay court was rounded out by a coterie of living attendants who'd been sealed up with the emperor as a reward for being his most favored. I gazed at the familiar handwriting. When Joss had sold me this map, she'd said it had come from a dying woman. Suddenly, I was appalled that I'd considered throwing the leather case into the sea. After I laid the old map down on the table, I covered it with a sheet of glass to protect it from the sea air, or from coffee spills. Then, following my internal script, I cleared the cabin of cups and plates and put away all the books on the shelves, secure behind their rails. But most importantly, Slate and I sat together, he in the attitude of a Buddha, cross-legged, and I with my knees drawn up to my chin. This wasn't our typical exchange, however, where I told him all I'd learned about the legend and era we were visiting, and he listened. Instead, it was my father teaching me. He was, as usual, an abysmal teacher, and soon enough I found myself shaking my head. "What do you mean you just let go?"
"Once you know where you're going, and you're sure it's there, you have to let go of where you're from. You look straight forward, you keep the land ahead in sight, and you don't look back."
"Literally or metaphorically?"
"Both. Once you sight your shore, you keep an eye on it, but you'll never see it if you're still in port."
"Running away and running too?"
"Sort of, yeah."
I frowned at him, but he seemed in earnest. Furthermore, he had no reason to lie. I'd shown him the map, and he'd admitted he had no chance of navigating there. My father knew almost nothing about ancient China. He had never read the Shuji. "How did you learn?" I said then. "Who taught you?"
No one.
He sounded surprised at the question.
"I taught myself."
"How?" He ran his hand through his dark blonde hair, and for a moment I saw lines of blue ink on his scalp.
I tripped.
I made a face. I should have known.
No, I fell. I was on the stairs. Maybe it was a little of both. I was at the library.
New York Public?
With the Lions, yeah. I used to go there when my... Christ, it was ages ago. When my own parents... They hated each other, fought all the time. I would go to the library and... It was different back then, 1981. The librarians didn't watch too close.
His jaw worked as he searched for words. But I stayed quiet, waiting. He spoke so rarely about his past.
I found an old... It was in a storage room, an old map. One of those architect drawings at the library from when it was being built. 1903, I think. There were photos, too. I must have been staring at it for hours. It was very real in my head. When I was leaving, I fell down the stairs, and there was a moment I could see the picture of Fifth Avenue, no concrete, and when I landed, it was face down in the mud. It was an accident, that first time. All I really wanted was to be somewhere else.
His eyes were far away, as though he could see that elsewhere from where he sat. In the silence, I heard the gentle lapping of the water against the hull. If you can go on foot, why did you build a ship?
It's a safe space, no matter where I go, and I can bring everyone I need with me.
He sighed.
It was easier back then. Nowadays, I don't know where I'd go without you.
Without me, you'd already be where you want to go, Captain.
No. Without you, I wouldn't be anywhere at all.
He dropped his gaze, and I was at least as uncomfortable as he was. I didn't know what to say, or rather, how to say it. I had imagined leaving so many times, but the excitement I'd anticipated had not rushed in. I felt hollow. He could have everything he wanted, but only without me, and I hesitated to leave. Why? Was it the fear I might be unmade? Or was it because, when I was free to go, I could remember all the reasons I had to stay?
Let's look at the map again, shall we?
He suggested then, and I sprang to my feet too eagerly. It was a challenging first trip, to put it mildly. Fairy tale maps were always the most difficult, and living terracotta warriors were certainly a fairy tale. But I was confident, the captain said I had to be, and Joss had said she'd seen me at the helm. We were to use all possible precautions for the journey. Kashmir had his long knife hung on his belt, and I'd watched Bee check the bullets in her revolver. Slate had a long piece of oak, a length of an old yardarm, and Rotgut, having carefully considered the strengths and weaknesses of a terracotta army, had picked up a hammer. I was the only one uncomfortable with a weapon. Fighting wasn't my strength. I wasn't even certain we'd need to. The warriors were there to protect the Emperor. We didn't plan to threaten him. But it was always best to be prepared, especially when traveling so far. After all, what else might we encounter in a place where clay soldiers came to life? What else did the mapmaker believe? As Slate took the helm and pointed us away from shore, I didn't wait for Bee to tell me to start hauling in the sails. Kashmir and I worked side by side in silence, clearing the deck, including my hammock and the washing rope, battening the hatches, securing the halyard, cleaning the drains and the scuppers, and tying off lines. It was as easy as the waltz we'd shared. We slipped past each other through tight spots without having to push. Hauled lines together that neither of us could haul alone, and knew what the other needed without having to be told. And yet, there was a quality in our silence that had never existed before, almost imperceptible from the outside, but such a difference, like salty water instead of sweet. It was the same feeling I'd had the night of the ball, as we'd stood on the deck. I'd been unable to speak then. I'd been unable to speak for years. I steeled myself. Kashmir? He was stringing the jack line, and he didn't look up, but by his face I knew he'd heard me. Kash. His shoulders rose and fell in a sigh, but he met my eyes.
Amira,
I just wanted to say...
You don't have to,
he said quickly.
It was my mistake. The other night, I thought...
He shook his head and laughed a little.
Well, will you forgive me? I only hope it hasn't hurt what we have.
My hand went to my pendant. The pearl was warm and smooth on my skin. And what is it we have? I asked softly.
Our friendship, he said, as you've said many times.
He searched my face.
Yes?
I hesitated, but only for a moment.
Yes.
He nodded, and after a moment he opened his arms.
Viens.
I stepped into his embrace, and he wrapped his arms around me, only to clip the jackline to my belt, giving it a yank. I gave him a shove in return, then I reached back and unclipped my line. I don't get one this time, remember? I've got the helm.
Oh, aye, Captain,
he said, grinning.
Why do you think the rest of us are roped in?
I stuck my tongue out at him. Tying in was standard for any difficult journey, where the rough seas and the margins might climb over the deck to clutch at our feet. Of course, no one but the captain had ever navigated the temptation, so none of us really knew what we might face when I took the helm. Would the fog rise for me? On deck, Kashmir would have to ride out whatever I steered us into. As soon as I attempted to navigate, the ship, my home, and the crew, my family, became my responsibility, and fear wrapped cold claws around my spine as I walked to the map room and shut the door behind me. I'd known for years how to use a compass and read the stars, but now, as I stood alone in front of the drafting table where the two maps lay side by side, on my left where we were, on my right where we were going, I didn't know up from down, much less east from west. My eyes slid from one map to the next, from the blue Pacific under the open sky to the silver sea deep beneath a man-made mountain, right off the edge of paradise and into the afterlife, as long as I didn't steer us into some kind of purgatory. I took a deep breath, then another, trying to calm my nerves. The smell of the maps and the books, the ink and the paper, helped me relax, and my hand went to the pearl at my throat. I bent my head and studied the map of the Emperor's tomb, turning the lines on the page into a shoreline in my head, the shore I would expect to see through the fog.
It will be there,
Slate had said to me.
And sort of not there. Do you understand?
Yes, I'd replied. And no.
Smartass.
And he had reached out to ruffle my hair, like he used to when I was little. But the memory of our conversation, that rare closeness, was cold comfort. I shivered then. The air actually was colder. I had to get to the helm. I took one last look at the two maps and left the cabin, but I paused in the open door. The sky that had been so blue not an hour before had faded to a tea-stained gray, and the sunlight, once golden, had the aged tint you see before a thunderstorm. The margins were coming up fast. I threw a glance back over the stern at the little island disappearing. Would I see her shores again? If Blake had chosen to thwart the Hawaiian League, I might never return. Against the biting chill of the stiff breeze, I wrapped myself in the memory of our kiss, my first, and walked toward the helm. Slate watched me warily as I approached, and it was several moments before he stood aside and let me take the wheel. My palms were slippery on the brass, which was still warm from his grip. I wiped my hands on my trousers and grasped the wheel again. Almost immediately, wisps of fog drifted up like steam from the steely water, the air thickening like churned cream. I heard Slate catch his breath. Goosebumps skittered across my forearms as I kept our course steady into the mist until it swallowed us completely. Would it lift again? Or would we join the other ships, the Flying Dutchman or the Mary Celeste, and journey without end, ghosts in the fog? The wind dropped, then gusted, then dropped again for a long minute. Suddenly it was back, whipping through my hair and lashing it against my cheeks. I couldn't see more than 30 feet ahead in the swirling fog, but the sea was calm, almost eerily so. I squinted as light flickered far away in the clouds, followed half a minute later by sullen, distant thunder and the taste of metal on my tongue. The wind snapped in the jib and I tensed. Then my father put his hand on my shoulder and squeezed. I gritted my teeth and tightened my grip on the wheel, still staring into the pearly mist off the bow. As my eyes slid across the insubstantial gray horizon, I became aware of an odd unspooling in the center of my chest, an incongruous, light-hearted feeling that made me want to laugh. At first, it was gentle, a tug and a flutter, upward like the rope on the kite I'd flown those years ago. And my body trembled as with the needle of a compass seeking north. Was this the draw of the faraway shore? Then came the counterpoint, a nauseating sinking in my gut, down like a fish on a line, and as we sailed farther into the margins, the drag deepened, like the haul of the anchor on its chain. But still something drew me forward, and in the center, I stretched like the sails in a gale wind. Sweat broke out on my forehead, and I swallowed bile. The muscles in my back grew taut, and my spine creaked as I tried to catch my breath. The pain in my chest was unbearable, and I thought I would start to fray like a rope. What was holding me back? I knew the answer before the question had finished forming, and I pushed the thought of Blake from my mind, letting that anchor drop away, down, down, until there was nothing behind me, and I was unmoored in the current, pulling me onward as steadily as time.
"Can't see a thing," Rotgut called from the lookout.
But suddenly I could. Through a break in the fog, a shoreline, vague but there, as though I were seeing a picture beneath a sheet of vellum. I blinked twice, and my eyes refocused. It was like that optical illusion where you hold a tube against the side of your hand, and you can see a hole right through your palm, clear as day, and yet impossible at the same time. I gave the wheel a quarter turn, and the ship creaked and dipped. "Do you see it?" I called, my heart pounding faster.
"Nothing yet,"
Rotgut said. His voice sounded very distant. I could no longer see him in the fog. A few drops of rain hit my cheeks. The sun dimmed in the sky, and the deck seesawed. Lights flickered at the edge of my vision, and I thought I heard the far-off groan of a mast under full sail. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Cash working alone to trim our main, hauling down on the hawser, straining against the swelling sheet. B was somewhere up near the bow, invisible in the fog. "Slate!"
"I'm going."
He left my side and went to Kashmir, but I had lost my concentration, and the hint of the shoreline vanished. I put the crew out of my mind as my eyes swept the horizon. I knew it was there. Yes, there. Clearer now, darker, just off the prow. The wind turned icy, and it carried a foul smell, like sour musk. My skin was clammy against my jacket, but I did not take my eyes off the shore. We pitched upward on a swell, down on its back, and up again on the next. The rain intensified, small, wind-driven drops that stung my face and lashed in bands across the black water. But I did not take my eyes off the shore. The sky darkened to charcoal, and the fog swallowed Cash and Slate, but I could still see the shore as clear as a mirror. Then the ship seemed to leap upward under my feet, and I fell to my knees as the wind and the rain simply stopped. Suddenly everything was still, and the cold darkness was absolute. My heart throbbed in my throat. Had I been struck blind? Blind and deaf? The silence was overwhelming. Then again, so was the smell. That cloying, musky odor I'd noticed on the wind. There was movement, too, an odd swaying of the ship. Then I heard Slate's laugh, wordless, delighted. Had he seen it, too? Our distant shore, the same shore I had seen? The fog was gone. As my eyes adjusted, I made out the glimmer of starlight above us and the silvery moonlit shine of the glassy water below, although I saw no moon in the sky. Then Rotgut swore. He lifted the lamp at the top of the mast. It wasn't the sky I was seeing. 100 feet above our heads, the light of our lanterns was glittering back at us from a ceiling studded with diamonds. In this cavern, the sky was a bowl with stars stuck on it. I recognized the constellations, Orion, or, in China, the face of the white tiger of the west, and Hydrus, the snake's tail. I hadn't seen moonlight on the calm sea. Rather, we floated on a rippling pool of mercury, just as Sima Qian had said. Where the waves of quicksilver lapped the shore, our light shone on the skeletons of dying trees, looming over piles of shriveled leaves on browning blades of grass. Far off, at the edge of the light, the gleam of red lacquer and bronze, the sarcophagus of Emperor Qian, in the center of the blasted, barren terrain. We'd done it. I'd done it. I was so proud of myself. It took me 3 heartbeats to realize the ship was listing. Chapter 29. The deck tilted starboard in slow motion. As the rudder twisted, the wheels spun. I grabbed for it, but it wrenched itself out of my hands. I clutched the base of the wheel and tried to haul myself to my feet.
"What's happening?"
Slate said, stumbling toward the mast and gripping it in both hands. "The mercury."
"What about it?"
"It's denser than water." Bea had slipped down nearly to the rail, but she was arrested by her harness. Kashmir was the only one still on his feet. He sprang past me to pull himself against the port rail on the high side, but it was too little too late. Creaking, the ship continued to tip. I looked up at Rotgut in alarm. He was wrapped around the mast. Even in the dim light, I could see the whites of his eyes. The glow from the lantern he held brightened as the crow's nest swung toward the wall and, with a crunch and a jolt, slammed into the stone. Rotgut cried out as the temptation stopped there, the deck at a 45-degree angle.
"My leg!"
I pulled myself up with the wheel. It didn't budge in my hands. The top of the mast had snapped, and Rotgut's knee was pinned between the platform of the crow's nest and the rough stone wall. He was gripping the flesh of his thigh in pain, but he wasn't moving, and I could see why. The slightest motion would send him scraping down the wall as the ship capsized. "No one move," I said, nearly afraid to breathe. "We need ballast." Slate closed his eyes.
"I wish you'd thought of that before we got here."
"Me too."
"Is it poisonous?"
Bea whispered, staring down at the silvery pool 5 feet below her. Her voice echoed oddly in the tomb. I don't know. Jin believed it was an elixir, but never mind," I said. "Just let me..." I half turned toward the hatch as the thought occurred, and even that slight motion made the ship slip sideways. Rotgut's scream echoed in the tomb. "Kashmir?"
"Amira?"
"The bag."
"What bag?"
"The bag on the nail, the one I used to bail the bilge. Can you go down and empty it?" He didn't bother answering. He unclipped his jackline and moved along the rail, hand over hand, until he was in line with the hatch. Then he let go and slid down, catching the opening with his fingertips and swinging inside. Rotgut screamed again as he slid another foot down the wall. We waited on deck, keeping our positions as though a gorgon had flown through. My palms were slick on the wheel, but I did not adjust my hands. I did not move a muscle but to tighten my grip until my arms shook. Rotgut sighed then, and after what felt like an eon, the ship began to tilt back aright. As soon as I could let go of the wheel, I scrambled over to the mast. Slate was already loosening the halyard. I shimmied up toward Rotgut, slowly at first, but the ship was more and more stable. I grimaced as I came eye to eye with the side of his shin. It had been skinned from knee to ankle, and blood dripped down his leg and off his toes. He screwed his face into the semblance of a smile.
"It's not broken. Looks worse than it is."
He wiggled his toes and then hissed through his teeth.
"But it feels worse than it looks."
The crow's nest was smashed, but the pulley below it was intact. I clipped Rotgut's harness to the halyard, and Bee and Slate lowered him to the deck. I climbed down after him, and by the time I'd arrived, Slate was using his shirt to staunch the blood. He looked up at me.
"It's like road rash."
"You know I've never ridden a bike." I wrinkled my nose at the sight of the wound. When daubed clear of blood, the scrape was the pale pink of the bottom of a rose petal. "There's a first aid kit in the cupboard under the desk." Slate put Rotgut's arm around his shoulders and helped him stagger to his feet.
"Come on, I've got some painkillers."
Rotgut laughed, and I made a face as they hobbled off toward the map room. I found Kashmir downstairs, sluicing water from his bare arms. I picked up his shirt. He'd tossed it in a wet linen puddle on the floor, and wrung it out into the open hatch of the bilge. "Good job," I said to him, tossing him the shirt.
"Quick thinking,"
he replied, clapping me on the shoulder. Then he smelled his shirt and wrinkled his nose.
"I think there was a dead whale in that bag. A small one, but still."
I laughed. "Change, then. I know you have plenty of clothes." I went into my own cabin then to get Joss's map, but I stopped when I stepped in a puddle. The porthole was shut. The water had come from Swag's bucket, upended on the floor by the starboard side. I grabbed it and swore. The little dragon was nowhere to be seen. I pawed through my things, but he wasn't under my quilt or in my jewelry box. My hands stilled, and I chewed the inside of my cheek. There was nothing else I could do. He knew where the pearls were when he wanted to come back. I threw a couple of dresses over the puddle to soak up the water, and grabbed the map case, slinging it over my shoulder. I joined the others back above deck. When I saw Kashmir, I shook my head, impressed. I was still bedraggled from the rain during our journey, but he'd even combed his hair. I stood beside him at the rail. The air was chilly in the tomb, and it soaked into my wet clothes and curled next to my skin. Together, we peered into the dim gloom. Waves from our sudden appearance still rippled against the sculpted shore to portside. The representation of the coast of China, where the emperor rested in the central place of honor. His servants would be elsewhere. All except one, his favorite.
"It's very quiet,"
Kashmir said. "It is. The sound of the water, the ship, our voices, all were swallowed by the darkness, and nothing came back out of it. Beyond the circle of light from the ship, there was no sign of life. The only movement here was our own." Cash sighed and shrugged one shoulder.
"Better than the alternative, I suppose."
My head was still light from the thrill, or from exhaustion, but I could still clearly recall the map I'd used to bring us here. "The terracotta armies would be in a side chamber," I said, crossing carefully to the bow. "The Sea of Mercury was bordered by the stone wall. Was that deep shadow halfway down its length a doorway? We'll need to row over there." Together with Kashmir, Slate and I stared at the dinghy.
"It'll tip without ballast," Slate said.
I know. I wrinkled my nose.